A Game Warden's children's book, titled A Cowboy in the Woods, is a story of Bobby, a boy who spends the whole summer observing wildlife, writing notes in his notebook, fishing with his dad, and keeping track of all the animals in his neighborhood, while trying to solve a neighborhood mystery. What he discovers is more than just an appreciation for the natural world. The idea for this book came from Wayne Saunders' own childhood experiences, growing up and exploring the woods and streams and lakes and ponds of his native New Hampshire. The love of nature instilled in his childhood led him to a career as a conservation officer. Wayne Saunders is a retired lieutenant conservation officer from the New Hampshire Fish and Game Department. Lindsay Webb is a naturalist, wildlife biologist, and environmental educator. Together, they collaborated with wildlife artist Ashley Mayers to produce The Cowboy in the Woods, the story of a boy whose love of nature leads him in unexpected directions. Available at wardenswatch.com and Amazon. Warden's Watch Podcast is now on Patreon, combining the Thin Green Line Podcast and the Warden's Watch Podcast on Patreon to bring member-exclusive extra content, both video, audio, and with product deals as well. Become a member to support our podcast and get something extra. Search Warden's Watch Podcast on Patreon.
We love our children. We protect them. We guide them. We prepare them for life in the world. With all that we do, from deep in our hearts, we cannot control all things. Life-threatening illnesses and disabilities affect far too many of our children each year. While we cannot change the circumstance, we can make dreams come true. Dreams to provide hope, to provide spiritual healing and strength, to provide moments of happiness and relief in the hardest of times. We can give a glimmer of light and hope in a time of darkness and despair. Join huntofalifetime.org to help make dreams come true, to provide hope for children with life-threatening illnesses and disabilities. Hunt of a Lifetime is a nonprofit organization fulfilling dreams for hunting and fishing trips to youth 21 and under with life-threatening illnesses and disabilities. Visit huntofalifetime.org to learn how you can make a difference.
Please join me, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and other Game Wardens on our adventures, protecting wildlife, saving lives, and having fun, all while serving the public and the natural resources of our planet. Listen to the tales and experience of those who work in the outdoors while being entertained with stories about encounters with poachers, wildlife investigation, murder investigation, near-death experiences, search and rescue missions, wildlife interactions from game wardens around the country and around the world. When I retired, I realized I couldn't let go of that legacy, but rather wanted to share the passion, the commitment, and the stories of those men and women that call themselves game wardens. This is Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and this is Warden's Watch. Warden's Watch, episode 83, John Demler, New Hampshire Fish and Game, Northwoods Law, former Army guy, John, 10th Mountain Division, which we got a lot of conversation in with that. As a matter of fact, our cover is going to be with him in his camo back in the day when he was, an infantryman with the 10th Mountain Division. So I thought that was really interesting, and it seems like all military is a good segue into being a game warden, but 10th Mountain Division, I don't know, just kind of that mountain thing. But although he talks about being deployed in Afghanistan and Iraq as well, not really your mountainous areas, but a very interesting conversation with that.
Yeah, the 10th Mountain is a great unit. I've worked with a lot of those guys, and they work like game wardens work, and they work very high altitude stuff, you know. And if he was anywhere near, the Pakistan border up in the Hindu Kush or any of those areas, that stuff is like the Eastern Sierras of California, jagged mountains, high altitude. So he was in some rough ass country, man. But you're right, Wayne. It's a really good base to be a good game warden, just like the retired SEALs and other guys we had on our Met team that ended up going into fishing game just because they were lifelong conservationists and hunters and anglers and love wildlife, and they served their country. And then they got to get their dream career after by going the game warden route. And this is a perfect story, man. He just follows that wonderfully.
Yeah, and as listeners, we have a lot of current service people listening to us. I know Steve Cass's son Nathan actually is a Marine, and he was thinking about getting out, and he reached out to me about, you know, the opportunities of being a game warden, and then he re-upped. So he's still a Marine, but he certainly listens to the podcast and, you know, shares it with his Marine friends and comrades there. And yeah, so it's pretty cool, and I really appreciate it. I think it's a great segue from going from, you know, any job in the military and then segueing in. So I think that's really cool. And this is pretty cool because we took John Demler's interview and we kind of made it a question and answer for our Patreon members. We put out there if you had some questions for John being on Northwood's Law. He, like he admits, kind of like me, he doesn't have a whole lot of episodes, but some of his episodes are very memorable. And he actually had to shoot a bobcat as they were releasing it, and it actually probably had rabies. I think they did test it and it had rabies because it wasn't, they were going to have that epic release like you do with the the Eagles, the, you know, the Bears and everything. They were all set up camera wise and the cat came out and turned on them and wasn't acting right. And it kind of was, and John had to end up putting it down, which is the reality of our job. But it wasn't exactly what they expected on an episode of Northwood's Law. And to their credit, they kept that and they played it to show more of what really happens sometimes.
Yeah, and that's kudos to a good production team and editors that are trying to capture, you know, the hard days. You know, it's not all fun and games. We don't ever want to have to do that. And certainly when the public sees that, because cats are so cool in general for our public to see. You know, John had a hard call that day and did what he had to do. And, you know, I've been there, you've been there. You know, I think we talked about this before. Four mountain lions I had to dispatch, you know, in my career. And it was all under the guise of, you know, and the reasons of public safety. And it was not a fun day. You know, that's not how you want to have to harvest any animal, you know, when that problem happens. But yeah, that was good that they showed it and show the challenges of what we do in the wildlife balance and urbanization versus conservation really working. You know, it's a fine balance, and that was a hard move for John to handle, and well done.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the questions that didn't make the question and answer session that came in late, and I think both of us, I want both of us to answer this as well, John, and then we can, for our Patreon members, they'll have an answer on Patreon from John. But it says, how much does all your daily equipment weigh, belt, vest, etc.? And I'm thinking in the range of 25 pounds, guessing. What do you think?
Yeah, I think on the heavy end. I know when I started as a cadet, I wore everything on the like, battle belt because I wanted to have everything on the battle belt and be overly equipped and too tactical as far as tactical.
Did you carry two sets of handcuffs back then too?
Yeah, I carried two sets of handcuffs my whole career.
You did? Okay.
Absolutely. Even on Met, we carried two sets of handcuffs. Yeah. Now, granted, we had them in compact pouches and really lightweight. You know, we had some of the high-speed, low-drag, light metal ones. But I always, you know, I'm sure John, in his careers he developed, you start going down the road, especially when you're packing a lot of weight in the military or on a Met team, you want to trim the fat. You know, you want to go minimalist and still stay safe. So I started every bit of 25 pounds, I'm going to say. But, you know, our level 3A vest got a lot lighter, you know,
very true.
A 20, 30 year span. The Safari Land one I was running when I was in patrol uniforms in and around Met was very light. And I'm going to say, you know, maybe 15 pounds even or less by the time we got down there wearing, you know, Cordura belts versus leather.
Yeah, good point.
Really, really good level 2 and level 3 holsters that are made out of really strong kydex, but featherweight. But 15 pounds still wears on you, as you know, Wayne.
Yes,
and
it does.
I'm sure John could attest to that, that even when you have a minimalist belt, it's still affecting you all day long.
Yeah, he's actually going to weigh his, so I asked him to videotape weighing his belt, so we'll have to see what that is. But good points on just the technology that has changed over the course of our careers and the lighter weights. And then it goes from tactical, what you were doing, to everyday duty sometimes is heavier. You know, I carried one set of handcuffs. I kept, you know, two, three sets in the cruiser. So I was prepared, but I didn't always have that on me for that option. And as we, you know, there's tasers, there's spray, there's key holders sometimes. Some of us carry knives. I know that's a big game warden thing in New Hampshire, is to carry the Buck 110 on your belt. It seems to be like what everybody likes to do. I always kept a Leatherman kind of hooked in my, with a clip on my pants, and not wear the Buck 110. But, you know, it's a great point that the technology has changed, which helps us. And have you put, it's funny, because after about 3 months, I put a uniform on with that same belt, and boy, my body did not like it.
Right. Well, and that's the thing, Wayne, we've seen, like when I was speaking and training with all the South Dakota game wardens last week, they wear a tac vest, just like we do in California for a regular uniform patrol, not even special operations. So they have a very light belt to hold their pistol, but then all of their impact weapons, their spray, their Leatherman, their magazines, their radios, their lapel mics, they're all on that. They're all in that kind of a plate carrier, that tactical vest.
Yeah.
And it zips up and your armor's in it. So, I mean, that's really been a game changer, because it takes all that weight off your lower back, distributes over the shoulders like a pack, and it's a lot more balanced. And I would say my tac vest that I was using toward the end of my career, when we had those approved, were very much pain relieving, lot more pain relief than, you know, lower trauma and stuff that you just have in your lower back after a while, but they were still pretty heavy. You know, it's just how that weight was distributed. So that's what, you know, are you going to weigh your tactical vest, if that's what you're running in your agency, versus a Sam Brown belt? I'll take the vest every day, man.
Yeah. I never had that option. It sounds really good.
So good in the vehicle.
Yeah. So great. We're going to hear from John Demler, episode 83, Warden's Watch. Thanks for listening. And if you get an opportunity to give us a rating, that always helps us on our podcast, whether it's Spotify, Apple Podcasts. And we are currently at a 4.9, so you might put us back onto that 5.0, which we're always looking for, huh, John?
Oh, yeah.
Cool. Thanks. On this episode of Warden's Watch, I'm sitting down with John Demler, New Hampshire Fish and Game, and Northwoods Law, because a lot of those people like you, John, on Northwoods Law. I see a lot of comments about you and things like that. So they really like your personality. I think they like seem like a real family guy. I shouldn't say seem.
No, it's on TV, so you never can. I mean, they could spin it any way they want, right?
They could. Yeah. They could, but yeah. I think that's the reaction I get from a lot of people. So much that it was the first time I reached out to some Patreon members and said, hey, you have some questions for, I sit down with John this week, and do you have some questions? And had him submit some questions. So I thought that was pretty neat. Didn't want to be overwhelmed, so I just put it out to our Patreon members, and we got some questions here that we're going to go through and answer, which is a first time for Warden's Watch getting, you know, people that listen.
Good.
Participation. So that's kind of neat. So, yeah, let's start off. You are a family guy, right?
I have a family.
Yeah. You have a family. I mean, the family guy just isn't a good.
Well,
after watching that show.
Yeah, right. And who? Every father, I guess, is a family guy.
Is a family guy.
In some sense, right.
So, yeah. I just see you labeled that a lot.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I guess I'm not sure why, because to be honest, I don't watch a whole lot of Northwoods Law, because it's like watching work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm the same way. People bring up episodes, and I'm not in a lot of – I'm in some, but people bring up things.
You're in
and
ones
I'm like,
that people remember, I think, the moose.
Some unique ones,
I'm
over like a more of a quality type guy versus that quantity, you know.
I wish I could say the same.
Yeah. I don't know. But, yeah, I think I mean, everybody's a family man, like I said before. I have a family, and it was part of the decision being, you know, transferring from my background and then becoming a conservation officer for New Hampshire was definitely a jump, but at the same time, it's worked out. And what I've learned is to try and balance as best I can, you know, my personal needs as an individual, the family, you know, what I want to do with my kids and what they want to do with me, and especially with my partner, my wife, Carla. You know, there's a lot of things that a marriage takes in general back and forth, but then also being a conservation officer has a lot of requirements, and it's easy to get roped into saying, like, you know, work comes first, but it doesn't always. But you also, sometimes you can't just sit back and do nothing and be like, well, I got this to do and I'm supposed to go here and do that. You do have to get your nose out to the grindstone and get into work and work some late nights, get some calls out in the middle of the night and not say, I can't do that. So,
right. And you came into this game married with a family.
Yep.
So that's a kind of a weird transition too for a family.
Yeah.
I came in as an individual, so it really didn't matter, but it certainly affects everybody, especially that first year where you are training, you're at the police academy. There's a lot going on there in that first year that you have to be really committed to.
Yes. Stop me if I go digress too far, because I can talk for days. I got stories forever, I feel like. But
that's good. That's a good podcast. Yeah.
People... I enlisted in the Army and served over eight years on active duty as an infantryman. Part of that, obviously, I was deployed to Afghanistan three different times and supported Operation Enduring Freedom. My wife and I met after my first deployment to Afghanistan. We had known each other a little bit,
Was that a dating site or something?
No. Oh. Yeah, it was a dating site. How far do you want to go to get into this story? No, I went to college before I joined the Army. My college roommate was from Watertown, New York. I grew up in Buffalo. And my wife's father is a ex-Green Beret medic and everything like that, who became a PA through the Army. His last duty station was Fort Drum, New York, which is also Watertown. So we were acquainted through college, because my wife went to school, Carla went to school in Buffalo as well. When I came back from my first deployment, I met up with all my college buddies again, and Carla was a designated driver for us one night when we were out, and the rest, I guess, is history.
Yeah.
So did kind of throw you right into, like, she was very familiar with the military lifestyle, but I, you know, we were married in a non-deployment time, in a dwell time, they call it. We're expecting our daughter, and I'm like, all right, see you later. I'll be back in a year. I'm going back to Afghanistan. And so we did that. Actually, I deployed two times with, you know, being married and trying to raise a family. And the Army, everyone says a conservation officer, you know, works crazy hours, but so does a soldier in the Army, especially infantry or something along those lines, where you're out in the field all the time or you're getting pulled to go for 28 days on a rotation to a training center. So coming out of the Army, the transition was, the scary thing was the Army does take care of a family. You know, they pay me as a soldier decently, and they provide housing and healthcare and everything like that. So the big jump of being like, all right, Uncle Sam's no longer going to just hold my hand, and as long as I do what I'm supposed to do, you know, get paid and live on post housing or get an allowance to go get an off post apartment or something like that. So it was kind of a scary thing to do, to leave that, especially where I was as a kind of like a staff sergeant and looking forward to a promotion type deal where I was living comfortably, as comfortable as you can in the Army. Mm-hmm. But we made it work. We used the GI Bill to go to school for a year and kind of applied everywhere just so that I had something that couldn't just go, you know, work at the pizza shop down the street or something like that and support. Because at that point we had my daughter and my son. So it was a transition, but I did. Everything worked out. I got hired at 30 years old by the Fish and Game Department. We were able to move to New Hampshire. And then I guess the rest is history. It's been
so going on. You weren't targeting New Hampshire at all.
I was. The decision.
You were. Okay.
It was a big. My last deployment to Afghanistan kind of was the point where I had decided my wife and I had talked a lot, and we decided I wasn't going to reenlist and stay in. That I was still young enough to try and find something else to do and an interest of mine. Growing up, I grew up in Wheatfield, New York, which is really like Niagara Falls, right on the Niagara River, just about 6 miles up or so from Niagara Falls itself. So we would go to a big state park, and they had like a state parks police that lived out there, Allegheny State Park, in like the western area of the state. And it was always cool because they lived in like the log cabins all by themselves, and like their job was just patrol the park. So in my mind, I knew what a game warden was. I didn't see him very much on the river. Usually it was a sheriff's patrol more than an NCON in New York I don't think I ever, other than seeing a boat go by every now and then, I never was fishing checked or anything like that. But I knew that they existed. I knew Parks Police existed. I knew, you know, that the Forest Service and on the federal side had law enforcement officers. So that kind of put me into the scope of like, well, if I'm going to get out and do something that I really want to do rather than go try and be a teacher or be a lawyer or something along those lines, why don't I really find something that fits what I feel is my skill set and like would provide an interest to me? And that just slowly, especially with the internet and Google searching and the more you read about things and talk to people. And I had known somebody from New Hampshire. And when you start to look at my family's from the greater Buffalo area. My wife's family, she's a military brat, but her family's from around Worcester, Massachusetts. So we're going to try and stay in the Northeast. Where do we want to go? Mm. And you look at New Hampshire, and I mean, I would never, I'm glad the way that my life worked out, but at the same time, I would have loved to have been born here and grew up in the town of Thornton where I live now.
Yeah.
And had, you know, had the experiences that, that it seems like the state has to offer. And like to raise a family, it's been awesome here. And we're really lucky that we, that everything worked for us, you know, the way that we decided to move forward, but also the way that I say there's a little bit of luck, but a lot of perseverance and kind of pushing and making things happen on our side. So
no doubt.
Yeah.
No doubt.
So
that's what makes it happen.
I applied just to a bunch of different agencies to try and cover if I needed to do something. Mm-hmm. And this was the Fish and Game Department was really kind of like, that was my goal, but you hear all these, and I'm sure everybody's heard this, or I don't know if you talked about it before in podcasts with people, but you know, thousands of people apply. They only hire one. Mm-hmm. You know, you're never going to be a game warden. They don't hire for 10 years at a time. So it's daunting, especially when you don't know, like I didn't have anybody that I did ride-alongs with or grew up with in New Hampshire. So I applied to New York State for their environmental police officers and their forest rangers. There's state police, and then I applied to New Hampshire State Police as well. And it was like, I think with my background and my experience, I should get a job somewhere.
You would hope so, yeah.
And then if I have to, I can always use that additional experience. If I got hired in New York or something, I could use that to say I'd like to move to New Hampshire. That was my goal. And luckily for me, it all just worked out like kind of one shot.
Did any of those other agencies reach out to you?
All the other agencies reached out to me. Yeah, it's funny that New Hampshire State Police, I think the day after, then Major Jordan called me, Kevin Jordan called me and offered me a job when I was living in Wanakena, New York, out in the Adirondacks.
Yeah.
I was ecstatic, I think.
It's the home of the Wanakena Ranger School.
It is. That's where I went to school for a year there. Yeah.
Okay.
So I think it was one of the captains from the state police called me to do my final commander's interview for the state police. And I said, well, I just accepted an offer with Fish and Game. He said, oh, okay. And so he sent me the whatever declination packet or whatever it was that I had to sign. So,
yeah. No, that's really good timing on our part for sure.
Yeah.
So your Army, did that help you does that help you with this job?
It definitely did. Yeah. It made me, it took me, so I enlisted when I was 20. And obviously had gone to school for a couple of years before that. Didn't really know what I wanted to do. Didn't have a direction. Enlisting in the Army taught me a lot about myself. Taught me definitely to trust in other people. However I was raised, I have a certain personality or background, but it definitely showed me that you have to be able to do what you can do. And that translates into this job. And my wife always laughs because I say, you know, I'm a problem solver. Like if there's a problem, I don't say, well, I don't know. I don't know what to do. I'm not going to do anything let's call somebody else. Like I want to solve the problem. And that was a big part of being in Afghanistan was nobody's going to take care of you. In some of the areas that we were, my experiences were very austere and people that are not very friendly to you. And next thing you know, you have a problem. There's literally nobody else that's going to solve your problem except for you or the group of people you're with. So to me, that is a big part of what we do, and that's why we all are so successful, because each one of us, you know, the 45 of us are individually a very good problem solver. When we get a situation that most other agencies or people or whatever it is can't solve, we're the ones that are like, well, we'll take, you know, we know what to do, or we don't know what to do, but we're going to figure out what to do because something's got to get done. So that's, I think, a big takeaway that I came from the Army with, and then I also just had the experience of, as a 26-year-old, you know, running a 20-man group of people in combat zone, and some of the other experiences that I had dealing with logistics and accountability of equipment and mission planning and everything the Army does, you really teach you to be a leader and teach you to know what you're at least talking about, because you can't say, yeah, I know how to do this, and then when you get called out, when the flame comes and it's time for you to jump through it, you actually can make it and get to the other side and do what you got to do. So,
yeah. And when I think of the problem solving thing and you just talked about, I think about when fire departments will sometimes start their own search and rescue missions, and then 2 or 3 hours into it, and they're like, oh, we better call Fish and Game now, because that's happened to me a couple times my career. And then you got to go start, like you said, whether it's unfixing things or fixing things or doing it your way. But that's happened a few times with search and rescue, that it's like an afterthought about calling Fish and Game. And then when it hits the wall, they're like, yeah, we better call Fish and Game now.
That's a real good example of it, because it does happen quite a bit. And,
And when they're quick and easy, I don't mind if they do that.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly it. No, a lot of people in a lot of, like, it seems like there's a safety net in the 21st century in America. It's probably good that most people don't ever have to face like a problem that if it gets too complicated for them, they can always call somebody. Or if they, like, you know, if there is an emergency, they will call an emergency service. But we are the emergency service, and sometimes...
In the woods. Yeah. When there's a problem in the woods, call the game warden. I think nationwide that happens.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I think it's pretty cool. It's listening to other stories around the country when it's in the woods. I think of Pennsylvania with their tracking team. You know, they're getting renowned for their human tracking team.
Yeah, exactly.
And when it steps off the pavement, they pick up the phone and call Pennsylvania trackers to track ManTrack.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool. Or tracking in the woods with dogs. It's just, that's where we operate.
It's exactly it.
And that's where you operated as an infantryman too, right?
Yeah, well, within reason, as much as wherever they said you're going is where we went. But
now, when you say Fort Drum, I always think 10th Mountain Division.
I was an infantryman in one of the infantry battalions there. So that's part of, like, well, it's been restructured a little bit, but the majority of the division is at Fort Drum in New York. So that's 10th Mountain Division. And it's a light infantry division. So that means it's not an airborne unit that parachutes, or it's not supported with extra helicopter assets. It does have an aviation unit as part of the division, but it's kind of primarily just light infantry. And I'll say the global war on terror. So between Iraq and Afghanistan, and you could go into, I'm sure there's podcasts and articles all over the place about this kind of thing, but it took the Army into a idea of that everyone was preparing to either go to Iraq or Afghanistan, and it got away from that, what they call full spectrum operations. But now I see a lot of people that I was in the Army with, I'm friends on social media with different groups, and they're getting back into that full spectrum training, and a lot of soldiers, the 10th Mountain Division is taking up utilizing skis and some of the Arctic training, and using what we call Akio's big sleds, and like getting into that, being able to go and be a light infantryman again in the mountains. And that's kind of fun. We did a little training here and there, but mostly you went to Afghanistan, you came back, you got new people, you got your equipment reset, and you started training again for your collective tasks, so that the whole unit could get ready to go back to Afghanistan within a year to a year and a half. So it kind of limits, like, hey, let's go to a mountain course. Like, now, like, we got live fires to do. We got, qualifier machine gunners, because we're leaving here in another, like, 8 months. So,
yeah, like, you're right. And that's the focus of the military at that time. So that's what they were focusing on when you said the broad spectrum is probably better.
But I did, I mean, of all the places that I went, I was in the eastern, kind of the northeastern part of Afghanistan in Kunar province, and was actually in the mountains. So, you know, people from the 10th Mountain Division have deployed all over to Iraq and Afghanistan, but especially in 2006 and 7 when I was there, and then again 2009, some of the places we were extremely, I mean, we're at 7,000 feet up to, I think we crossed over 10,000 feet in some of the mountains out there, and it was rugged. And it makes me really appreciate now when I have to go up onto Franconia Ridge and I just have like a little bit, you know, it's a light summer day and I got a summer pack with some extra first aid and some extra water and a little bit of clothing. And I'm like, this is nothing compared to wearing armor and ammo and then carrying a ruck that's basically 90 pounds or whatever the garbage that we have in there. Because if you can stand up with a rucksack on, you probably have not enough stuff in there. You're going to get a mortar round, or you're going to get more ammunition, or you better carry like an extra combat lifesaver kit or something. So
because that stuff's heavy when you start talking ammo. That's definitely heavy stuff. So let's bang out a few of these questions. Perfect. Because I don't want to get through 2 hours of podcasting and then go, oh, I forgot the questions.
No.
So let's do a few and we'll split them like half and half. So Connie R, I'm not going to say their last name in case they don't want to say it. So do conservation officers, like other law enforcement officers, have to periodically qualify with their firearms? If so, how often?
Yes, they do. So New Hampshire.
And you're a firearms instructor, right?
I am a firearms instructor for the
department. Excellent question for you.
Yep. So, the short answer is yes, we do. And to get into that a little bit, is a conservation officer is a full-time law enforcement officer in the state of New Hampshire, and we have a police trainings and police standards and training council, so PSTC, that puts out every full-time certified police officer and then also part-time police, you know, whoever's going to serve as a police officer, it puts out the minimum requirements that they have to do each year, and part of that is qualifying. That in of itself is fairly basic. I mean, you have to meet a qualification standard, but what we do, we not only qualify once a year, which we're required to do, and you know, we turn that into the police academy or the police standards and training council so that they can see that. But we do an additional training on top of that, and then we conduct usually a fall training, so every officer gets another chance to use their firearm, and then we do some scenario-based training, which is very good for us, and it really is a kind of a real-world experience. We take things that we've run into or things that happen and put people into with like a simulated firearm type situation, like almost like a paintball gun, but scenarios that are very kind of high stress and get you thinking, and then we talk about it and analyze it. And so I think that's good. It's one of the more important things. We're just meeting with the chief firearm instructor yesterday, Brad Morse, myself and one of the other firearms instructors. And it's really one of the most important things we do, which is kind of sad to say. You know, it could be a very, very short incident, but it could be one of the most important things to do. It could be the choice of, you know, whether or not to utilize like your firearm in like a lethal force situation, or whether or not something happens where you have to disengage, or if you do have to engage. Like, it's a lot of stuff that people don't like to focus on, but it is important. And 99.9% of the time, it's not even something that we think about. But I mean, especially you can, I'm sure, and have talked about, you know, it's that one day that all of a sudden everything is extremely important, because it could be the difference between you being killed or, you know, you having to take a life or something along those lines. And to know all the legal ramifications of it, you know, to be able to think clearly in those types of situations, it's a lot. But we have such a wide variety of other things that we do that we don't want to focus on. You know, our job isn't just to be, we're not a SWAT team. We don't go and, you know, try and kick in doors. We're not very kinetic, like about 0% of the time, I think probably is what it averages to, that an officer's actually thinking about whether or not they're going to have to draw their firearm. So
that's absolutely.
But
that training kicks in, and that's why we train like that. It becomes second instinct. Yep. I'm sure you've had it. All of a sudden you got to draw your gun and you don't even remember drawing it. It's in your hand and ready to go, because we do it so often. You get so used to, when you come out of the police academy, you've drawn your gun, I don't know how many hundreds of times.
Yeah.
And through training, you draw your gun. So all of a sudden you need your gun and it's in your hand before you know it. And you didn't even think about it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And that's what it's a requirement. It's every one of us now, especially now, there's no officer. Like it's funny. I say I'll be approaching my 8-year mark, which is kind of crazy. I still feel like I'm a newer guy, but I'm not. But anybody that got hired, you know, it's a law enforcement position and we do have a responsibility. I mean, we all took an oath and said that we're going to take care of people. And part of that is if somebody's out there that's causing issues or threatening somebody's life, like we have to be able to respond appropriately. And there's a lot of training that's involved in that. You can't just take a gun and a badge and then go do something and say, all right, if something bad happens, you'll know what to do. Like, right. No.
But as game wardens, we probably use our firearms more than any other law enforcement officer.
That's true. Yeah, that is definitely true. And that's in regards to animals.
And having to deal with sick and injured animals. Yeah. And unfortunate part of the job, but we do it a lot.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Because that's how you have to deal with some of those. That's the most humanitarian way to do it, when an animal's injury, you definitely put it down.
And then, and explain to somebody that doesn't think that's how it should be. Yeah. Usually we do a lot of that too.
Yeah. No, it's definitely a tough situation, especially when there's a crowd around.
Yeah.
And it's a fawn or something, and it's got a broken leg that's never going to be fixed.
I'll do a quick transition. You're bringing it up. So the game warden tip that I've picked up is that if I'm going to shoot an animal and there's a lot of people around, I usually shoot it 3 or 4 times, like, you know, the old, like, double tap, if you will, right away. because I've had it, and everybody has, where you take that one shot and you're like, yep, this is going to put it down, and it doesn't. And then it's 30 seconds go by and 45 seconds go by and everybody's looking at you and you have to shoot it again.
Mm. Right?
And then maybe that does it. Maybe it doesn't. You have to shoot it another time. Who knows? But if you go bang, bang, bang,
mm-hmm.
you've shot it three times. You have three times the wound channels. You have three times the lethal hit probability. You've ended its suffering. And nobody says, oh, you had to shoot it three times, you know? You say, oh, yeah, he came and he put it down, right?
Yep.
So that's my game warden tip for the day, euthanizing animals.
That's not a bad idea. I shot a moose once right in the head, and it turned and looked at me.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody, again, you said, everybody's like, oh, no, shoot it again. I'm like, it's dead. It just doesn't know it yet.
Yeah.
It's just give it a – it didn't take long. It was, you know, a shotgun slug. But, yeah, but it's just – that's one of those things that you're right when you say that. And then I had one that was down, a deer that was down. I went to grab it to drag it off the road.
Oh, boy.
And it kicked me in the gut.
Yeah.
Like its last throw kicked me. It knocked me down, knocked the wind out of me. I had three or four people standing around. And, of course, I can't talk because the wind's knocked out of me. And everybody's like, are you okay? Are you okay? And this deer hadn't moved at all. And I went to grab that leg and it wound up and just that little,
yeah.
I was afraid it penetrated my gut the way it kicked me.
I bet.
But I was laying, I remember like this people all standing around. They're like, right above me. Are you okay? And I can't even talk because the wind was knocked out of me.
Yeah.
So another lesson learned is give it a little time. I had another one. This is a funny story. Stark, my fire department, responded to an accident. There's a moose dead in the road. So I'm like, the moose is dead? Yeah, well, yeah, it's dead, Wayne. So I learned this little trick. It's kind of funny, and it was kind of showing off, too, that you can spin an animal, and you can spin him off the road. You just get that kinetic energy moving in a circle, and I could move him right off the road. So I was kind of showing off. Well, I grabbed that antler and started to spin. Yeah, he wasn't dead. Yeah, that was and that moose tried to get up with me right beside him, and I'll tell you what, I did the dance like you wouldn't believe.
I bet.
And the firemen are all like wide-eyed, and they're like, oh, we're sorry. We thought he was dead. I'm like, again, one of those things you live and learn, and yep. you make sure he's dead before you try to show off.
That's right. But see, you learn through experience. So.
Yes, you do, and I wish I could have started all over again with all my experience and from the beginning, but I think when you're by yourself, you learn so much more. It's that first year you're training with an officer and you learn a lot, but that first year on your own, I don't know if it was for you, it was an effort because now it's all my decision making, so it's just figuring out the way you want to do it as an individual.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. No, I agree there.
Okay, we got to move on to questions, but that was that. See, Connie, we just morphed into all kinds of things off of your questions.
I can talk, that's
a problem. Yeah, Terry D. What would you say was the toughest call you ever had to respond to?
So I put a couple notes there. Obviously, we tough. I'm assuming you're talking about like emotionally, like just all in all. Like if we were to sum it up, like that's a tough call. That's a tough day.
Mm-hmm.
So I will say, like we do a lot of physically demanding things, search and rescues, and sometimes you get called and they plop the pin way out there on some trail, and you're like, oh, that's a garbage trail, that's so far up, it's so steep, we're gonna have to use it's gonna be a long, long day, and the weather makes up for it to be really rough by the time you're done, you're exhausted. So those are always tough, but we deal as law enforcement officers, we deal, especially Wayne, you're up there in the more northern country. I'm in a fairly populated area, but there's still not a lot of law enforcement, so I've been called and had to deal with suicides and things like that, and that's always just a horrible situation because of the background of however it came to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somebody was at their worst point in their life, and then everybody around them's trying to deal with that. So I can remember, especially one in Wentworth where the ambulance was waiting to go and nobody was around. And I actually was coming back in November from sitting on a field, and you know, it was shots fired, and then is it a suicide? Or you show up to one of those things as the first officer really to secure the scene and figure out what's going on, and there's the family there and the person who decided that they had to take their life, and it shakes you up. It's seeing everybody else be so worried and distraught and just trying to figure out the humanity that's left in everybody there and how to go about approaching the situation carefully and trying to, you know, you can't make anybody happy. And I think that's what I like to do and that really disturbs me, is like, everybody, there's nothing I can do right now other than just be here, I guess, and wait for somebody else to show up and the EMS, you know, come in and everything like that. So those are always, dealing with things like that is pretty rough, I feel like, and those I would consider are way tougher than anything physically demanding. Yeah.
No, I would totally agree with you. And just anything with death, you know, just delivering that message to a family that their lost person, you know, the people they love, they're not coming home because we found them and they are deceased. Yeah. So.
I don't do much of that yet. I leave that for
Yeah, you leave you guys. That for the higher ups. But that was the toughest things I had to do. And yeah, learned a lot through doing that. But definitely was tough to sit down with a family and tell them that we've recovered your loved one, but, you know, that they're not alive.
Yeah. So
whether it was a suicide, whether it was a search and rescue mission, or, and then there's the suicides you go to that just are sometimes can be extremely graphic, that etch in your brain for the rest of your life.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah. So no, that was another good question, but Tracy A., what was going through your mind when that bobcat that you and Maria worked so hard to rescue came stumbling out of the crate?
Well, so everyone's talking about it in Northwood's Law.
Yeah. Again, it was one of those memorable moments, John, that you were involved with.
So what was going through my mind directly at that moment was just, I mean, it was a little bit of surprise to... The cameras were all set up with the film crew that it was going to run into the woods and they were going to get the shot of it after all the rehabilitation. Because normally we wouldn't, like I talked to my boss, Jim Nealand, about going down. I picked it up and then we took it to the rehabilitator and they were going to go to the vet and take the quills out of it. And he's like, you know, he was not so thrilled about it all because it was taking me away from just regular patrol. But at the same time, for me, it was a fun experience to be able to do all that. So I figured, everybody assumed at that point the bobcat was going to run away and do its normal thing. And so when it came out, when it stumbled out of the crate and turned towards us, I'm like, well, it took about a half second for me because, you know, your thought process is that it's going to run away. And then when it doesn't happen like that, now you're into, you have to assess and analyze and then come up with a plan of action. And my brain only
in
works
minute,
so fast.
Seconds.
Yeah. So I'm like, oh boy. And it seemed like a long time. I know it wasn't, but I kind of backed up and it was circling and it was sort of coming towards Maria and I, and I think I was able to get in front of Maria and circle a little bit more. And I asked Maria, like, it's got rabies or something. I'm like, I'm going to shoot it, like, as a question. Not that she was like, oh no, it's just the anesthesia is wearing off or something. And she was like, yeah, you know, mumbled something. And so I got her to step away. I was able to circle away from the camera crew so that I wasn't shooting towards anybody. And then finally it was, I shot it. And as I'm doing all of that, it's not on the TV show. They must've taken it out, but I'm yelling like, don't film this. Cause it's a joke type thing. It's like, oh boy, this isn't what we thought it was going to be. But I'm glad, truthfully, I'm glad that show came. I figured it wouldn't have gone on to the show. Yeah. And then when they are like, oh yeah, your bobcat's going to be on there. I'm like, well, good. Cause that's what happened.
That's the reality.
The way
of
it goes sometimes.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. I like to bring that aspect into Warden's Watch to let people know that it's just not, you know, because they like to put that on the show a lot of saving the animals, saving the animals, saving the animals. And I remember Glenn with his loon, the first one. I had gotten the call about the loon up at Back Lake from Sheldon Belanger, who was doing a detail up there, state police. And he called me about it. I said, okay, when tomorrow comes, we'll have Officer Egan will go up there and grab it and see if it's still alive or whatever. I got up in the morning and I heard Glenn had gone up that night and picked it up and drove it all the way to Concord to the animal hospital. So yeah, but that was the beginning of Northwood's Law. And all I did was call up Glenn and I'm like, hey, I got that call earlier. And I hope you don't think you got paid for last night. Because technically, if you're going to be over, you're supposed to call your supervisor. So.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So that came in there. But as a supervisor, he's a supervisor. He's a sergeant now. I think he would have made the same call.
Yeah.
It's just funny because they don't see the other side in the show. They see what's portrayed.
Yeah.
But there is, you know, we put down a lot of animals and it's necessary.
Yeah. It definitely is one of the things where the show definitely does a good job, I think, of showing what we do.
Mm-hmm.
But there is an expectation that we rehabilitate everything and there's so much in regards to wildlife that we can't even come close to rehabilitating. And it's
even the rehabilitators will tell you that.
Yeah, or you take it to them and then they have to waste their time to euthanize it, and you know, and it's either donated, whatever they got to do and deal with it, and you feel bad. So after a while, you definitely figure out what stands a chance and what doesn't. And
yeah,
ultimately, I mean, by RSA, our job is to deal with wildlife.
And we get a soft spot too, especially the older you get.
Yeah.
But even as a young warden, I had this crow that I was trying to catch. It was like March, and this crow had a broken wing. And he had chiseled out in the snowbanking a spot where cars would go by. He'd hide in his little cave. And so I tried to catch him one day. And I couldn't because he had so much juice in him. He'd jump, and it was like 3 feet of snow, and he'd be hopping in the snow, and I'd be trying to get him in the snow. And I couldn't catch him. So weeks went by. I tried catching him like 3 weeks in a row. And finally I caught him because he had no energy. He hadn't been eating.
Yeah.
And finally I got him, but I couldn't put him down because we had this relationship now, me and this crow. So I called Kathy Gregg and I told her the story. I said, I know generally I don't bring crows in, but this crow's kind of special. So, and she's like, she kind of laughs. She's like, bring in the crow. So she splinted his wing, released him. She named him Survivor.
Yeah, there you go.
Because of the story. And she released him. And she, you know, to this day, me and Kathy always talk about the crow that I brought in as a young game warden, too. Yeah. But I just, after 3 weeks of trying to catch this bird, and then I catch him, I'm like, I know I generally don't bring a crow into a rehabilitator, but it kind of, I didn't have the heart after he tried so hard. I mean, to chisel that little hole in the snowbank and out where he could get away from the cars. Every time a car came, he'd stuck in there, and finally I was able to catch him. So, yeah, no, let's go with another question. But that was a good question on the bobcat, because that's, again, that's what everybody remembers you about. Is you, like you said, you don't have a lot, but I think what you have is memorable.
That's good, yeah. It was a surprise, and that it was on the show.
Yeah, exactly. Susan P., did you always want to be a game warden?
No, Susan, I didn't necessarily always want to be a game warden. I know a lot of people, especially that I talk to and people I work with, say I grew up, you know, the first time I ever got checked, I knew that's what I wanted to do. I didn't, and I'm really glad. I made a decision kind of, I don't know, I'll say early in my life, because I think I'm not even, I got tons of time to go still. So, but I made a decision to come and do this. Like I said, I joined the Army. Really, I don't know if people know this or not, I played drums, and I don't very much anymore, but I was used to be really good. I was planning to go to school for that. I was in the New York State, like all state jazz band and things like that.
Wow.
And, so that's what my plan was. And then senior year, I just changed my mind and wanted to be a communications major because I didn't want to go be like a professional percussionist. It seemed like a lot of sitting around. And anyway, so I kind of didn't know what I wanted to do. And the Army shaped me, informed me, and gave me a purpose and taught me a lot about myself. And then that was the decision, you know, as I was approaching 30 years old of like, yes, this is now what I'm looking forward to doing. And this, I feel like, would be an awesome job. And the, you know, Northwoods Law wasn't a show at the time, so I didn't have that much of an insight. I bet it would have helped me be even more excited about it. But at the same time, I just knew that I wanted to work in some kind of capacity outdoors. And it seemed like New Hampshire had the best mix of between. So some people don't like search and rescue. I don't mind doing search and rescue, but we, you know, we do search and rescue. We do snowmobiling, four-wheeling. We do traditional game warden duties. We do law enforcement duties. We do public interaction. It's a lot of variety, and it's awesome. And I wouldn't change how I came to be, I guess, but I kind of, in the back of my head, I always wonder, like, what if I'd started out, just went to college and then came right as a game warden. I wonder what my life would be, and I wonder if I would like it as much as I do now. But I wouldn't change things because I'm here. I'm in the here and the now. But
hearing you doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think you're right. Northwoods Law, Lone Star Law, Wild Justice, all those shows help people learn about the job and see if they want it. So I think it's a good recruitment tool. I'm hoping this podcast, I know this podcast is a good recruitment tool. I've had like six people from around the country say, hey, thanks for your podcast. I just got hired here, just got hired there. And it's pretty inspiring to me because that's exactly what I want this podcast to do, isn't to inspire the next generation. Just like my book, you know, A Cowboy in the Woods.
Yeah.
I want to start inspiring that next generation at that young age so they read A Cowboy in the Woods and my interaction at 6 years old had an impact on me, and I hope this book has an impact on them. And that's really why we're down here, is because I'm going to your wife's school to read to her class the book.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I can't take total credit. I always, Lindsay Webb pretty much did a lot of the writing, my story, my expertise, but she certainly had the expertise of having a young boy at that age too, so she knew how to write things. So I try not to take all the credit, but it seems like a lot of the times everybody thinks it's my book, but it was definitely a team effort. Yeah, yes.
There you go. A collab, isn't that what they call it now?
For sure. Audrey W., since you have been on the job a while now, what was the biggest surprise about what the job entailed, good or bad?
I say it's hard. I wrote a little note on this because it's an interesting question, and it's funny. I was saying I've been on the job a while. I guess I have. And at 8 years, to me, things are normal that to other people, and you now having retired and everything, you're like, oh, yeah, that's part of the job. But to a lot of people in the world or country, however you want to look at it, even in the state, are just amazed at the opportunities that we get to interact with wildlife or the missions that we have to go on and things like that. So one of the biggest surprises for me, I guess, is just how much you are able to like develop your own area. And like, you know, I have 9 towns that I cover normally, and really there's nobody, it's my responsibility to deal with everybody here. So that was very surprising. I don't have to go to, you know, the office and check in the morning. I don't have to go and do a daily brief or anything like a regular police work, or definitely in the military, I don't do a patrol brief before each patrol, or, you know, I don't conduct a pre-combat check. It's up to me to do everything. So I like the independence, and it was fairly surprising. And I can, just being a young officer, I can remember as a trainee actually riding on a four-wheeler, like, I'm getting paid right now to ride around on the four-wheeler. I mean, this is awesome. It's all, when you're new, I think it's all like a surprise of like, wow, I can't believe that this is part of my responsibility. Or, you know, I picked up a bunch of turkey poults and brought them to the kids real quick before I took them to the rehab, or so they could see all the little chicks and everything, the poults. And every day was kind of a surprise. And even now, there's still some things that you're like, wow, I can't believe I'm doing this, or this is something that I never thought I would be involved in, but here I am. So the job is definitely a doorway to a lot of different things, and that's what I like about it, just a wide variety of things.
Yeah, you're right. It takes a special personality to do it, because you're right, and you're relied on a lot by the department, by your supervisors, to do the job within your patrol and do it well, and to be that ambassador for the department as well as the enforcer.
Yeah.
It's definitely, and you can focus on certain things or not focus on certain things. So, and hopefully some of those things don't rise to the attention of your supervisors if they're not being paid attention to, because then you'll be directed to pay attention to them.
Exactly. No, that's exactly it.
Yeah. No, that's pretty neat. And, you know, I always looked at my whole area, go where the activity is, because, you know, we had very active area in the Pittsburgh area with snowmobiles and ATVs. And I always encourage the guys, making sure there's coverage, you know, district wide, but go where the activity is. You know, certain times of year, it's in different places doing different things. So if it requires 2 or 3 officers, take 2 or 3 officers. Just don't leave one behind. That was always my motto. So,
yeah, and to respond to whatever
to respond.
Happens.
So there's a green uniform at a rescue early on. We're on page 2. So Kathy B., what is the most gratifying part of your job and the most difficult?
I think one of the more gratifying parts is just working with people. So a majority of almost all of my interactions with people are positive, and that is very something that makes me happy, is to make other people happy. Even like, we're coming out of snowmobile season, so a prime example of writing speeding tickets. I mean, I sit on it straight away, and it's almost like shooting a fish in a barrel. If somebody has the itch for speed, I got them right there. And this whole winter, which was a short season, well, I'll complain about that a little bit. We had a rough winter for snowmobiling, but this whole winter, I didn't have anybody upset with me that I'm writing them a ticket. And by the end of it, it's always a joke or a friendly exchange. And they're getting summonsed, but it's a violation, and it's a smaller fine, if you will. So I think that's just gratifying in general, is that people have a respect for you. And I try to treat people, you know, in the sense that regardless of the situation, I want, if I were in their, if they were in my shoes type deal and they were the one issuing me the ticket or giving me the verbal warning or whatever, you know, that I would want them to be treating me in such a way. Yeah. So for me, most of my interactions that I have with people, even in kind of what would be more extreme situations, are usually very pleasant, or they end on a positive note. And I can see I either got the message across, I enforced the law that I needed to, or I generally made a friend, or at least somebody that respects me and understands that I'm here doing what I do. So I think that's probably one of the most gratifying things, is that I'm a member of my community and I'm a part of my patrol, and I make my own destiny here for myself, I guess. The difficult thing, I mean, is the reverse of that, is when you get somebody that is completely just a jerk, if you will, and you know, you catch somebody doing something they're not supposed to, and then it becomes your problem. You know, I'm the problem. Mm-hmm. Like, you were the one that was on posted property that killed a deer illegally. You know, the consequences, there's consequences for your actions. Mm-hmm. I'm not being unfair to you. I mean, fair is, you know, kind of.
Sounds like you've had this conversation before.
Oh, yeah. But at the same time, you know, they fight you tooth and nail, and mm-hmm. they don't want to accept responsibility for what they did. None of us, I don't think, go looking for trouble. We're not trying to like create something out of nothing. But when things happen and people make decisions, just accept the consequences. If you made a bad decision, you know, we all try to rationalize and justify our actions to ourselves all the time. You know,
and we appreciate that and respect it.
Yeah,
too.
And some people are really good at it and able to accept. Like if you accept what you did, and I'm telling you, look, this was a problem, we're going to move forward with it, and you say, okay. And that makes me feel good. And I feel like that's what we're hoping for. But when you get somebody that fights you and is, you know, calls you names and hires a lawyer that, you know, tries to shoot you down and makes life just miserable for me, who is all I'm trying to do. Look, I didn't create this problem. You created this problem. I'm just trying to uphold the law that we've all decided as society, we've said, no, you're not supposed to do this because that's either unfair or unethical, or, mm-hmm. you know, it's going to hurt somebody else or hurt, you know, the wildlife that can't call the police on, you know, if Joe Deere gets shot, Bob Deere doesn't call us and say, hey, my buddy just got killed illegally. So that's a kind of a crazy thing. And some people just are of that personality or upbringing that they won't accept what they've, you know, their actions have consequences, and they'll fight you and make your life miserable. So that is a difficult part for me, and I don't like it when people don't like me because I try to be likable.
And I've had those things. And look, the guy I appreciated the most, we knocked on his door. He opened the door, and he's like, you got me.
Yep.
Vietnam vet, Leo, great guy. To this day, I always enjoy seeing him. But open the door, you got me. And I'm like, we got you what? You know what you got me at.
Yeah.
And that's, he paid his fine. And another guy in the same case, you know, just like you said, was just fought it. When one says, you got me, and the other guy says, nope, I didn't do it.
And
yeah. So been there, done that, understand it. But those are good answers. Mike P., do game wardens in New Hampshire have a set work schedule, minimum floating requirements? I know all of you work crazy hours, just wondering how flexible it is.
So we have a schedule, as in we have days on, so we have days that we're scheduled to work, and then we can work kind of the way that we see fit to our patrol. You know, generally it's an 8.5-hour day is what we would consider our regular day, but there's a lot of flexibility in that. Like around here, if I get up during the summer, first thing in the morning, I'm not going to say that I'm only going to run into people fishing that are fly fishing enthusiasts, but I have a lot of rivers and brooks, and it's pretty much everybody's fly fishing and not your average recreational fisherman that might not have their license or might be taking an over limited trout. So sometimes it's for me to work better in the evenings. And I decide that I'm going to start my day at 9 o'clock and then work into the evening, or come home for dinner and then go back out and hit a lot of the national forest campgrounds and everything around here. So that's just an example. We do have a lot of flexibility, and that's one of the good parts, really good parts about this job. We do work crazy hours, but they're not crazy to us because we're trying to, I mean, I think every conservation officer, especially in this state, you know, has a focus of, we want to catch somebody that's out there doing something wrong, that's intentionally doing it. And so for us to work late hours during hunting season, or, you know, work, sit all night on a field, or go and try and get a decoy shot or something, that that's not too crazy for us, because that's really what we're here to do, and that's one of the most important parts of our job. So not does everybody always understand that? Does my wife and kids always understand that? That's what I talked about maybe in the beginning about trying to balance everything. I could work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week and make a difference, but what difference am I making for my family, and you know, how is that going to balance out in the long run?
Good answer. Understandable too. And your supervisor certainly wants you to be working the activity too, because if you're signing on at 6 and signing off at 2, then they're going to be like, what about the other stuff?
So, yeah, exactly.
So we have a tendency to keep an eye on that too, to make sure you're keeping things in line in your area, so to speak. You're right. It's a balancing act. So we certainly understand that, hey, sometimes the family comes first too.
Yeah.
Even though the smelt's running somewhere and you got to go to a play.
Yep. And we are lucky. I mean, people, you hear it a lot about people, oh, you guys work crazy hours, you guys do this, and you guys are on subject callback, or if there's something big, you can get called. And a lot of that is true. But, I mean, it's no different than somebody that works a midnight shift or, you know, that there's a lot of people that are less, have a more intrusive work schedule than we do in a lot of different careers. And we're afforded the flexibility. Like I said, like you're talking about a play, like how great is it? I've done it, where during hunting season, it's the fall play and I'll go to the play. It, you know, finishes at 6:30 or whatever. And then I go back out, you know, I can go back out for another hour and a half or something like that. Go sit in a field and then go, you know, then switch and meet up with somebody and like work another group of fields for the evening. Like it's not like I have to be in a warehouse, like, or I don't have to be at a retail job or at a factory for that entire period. It does afford us a lot of flexibility. And I think I'm lucky because, you know, the supervisor that I have understands that, and the group of people that I work with in our district 3, which is a pretty big area, you know, we all kind of have that same idea of like, we make things happen, but at the same time, we can't let our families go. Josiah is a great example of that, right? He's always trying to balance everything.
He's got a lot of family going on there.
Cub Scoutness and yeah.
3 boys with his personality. Yeah. He's running every which direction. So his wife's going to heaven for sure. Our last question, Joy A. First of all, the game wardens of New Hampshire all seem to be so kind and caring. They haven't met all of them, so right. I'm wondering what it's like to raise a family and work the hours that you do. We covered a lot of that, Joy, and a lot of it, but I'll let John step up to the plate on that. Things we didn't cover?
No, I say it is. So the schedule, I mean, it's a lot more forgiving than being in the military. Coming out of the Army, you know, you went on leave when they said it was time for everybody to go on leave, or, you know, you wanted to go to somebody's wedding and it was in the middle of a big training event. You're not going. Yeah. You got to be to work at, so especially as you become like a, you know, as a supervisor, if you're a sergeant and you're in charge of just 4 people or 5 people, and you're a staff sergeant, you're in charge of, you know, 9 people, or a platoon sergeant and being at more than that 40. So if everybody has to be there at 6, then you have to be in there at 4:30. You know, like it gets more and more crazy. So I do like being in charge of myself. I do like having that flexibility. Really, I guess we talked about it now several times, but it has been great for my family to just have them be kind of a part of my life, where as a game warden, I can take them to see places that I've discovered. I can bring things here. I bring animals home all the time. A lot of them are dead, just so that like, hey, I picked this up, but have you guys ever seen whatever?
Right.
And, you know, it's been pretty crazy to think about just what they've been exposed to already. I think it's a good, depending. And again, everybody's different. There's different personalities and different family types and every dynamic is different. But for my wife and I, and then my kids, it's been really so far a good career to be able to work and kind of enjoy like what I do, and then that translates into being a happy person as a family man too. So obviously some days are stressful, some days are busy, but at all, I think the whole balancing act that I've more or less can pull off now is made it comfortable for me, made it comfortable for my kids, made it comfortable for my wife. So
yeah, And you're right, your family becomes part of the fishing game family, really.
Yeah.
They can answer a lot of the questions that you answer.
Yeah. And it's like they do have a lot of unique experiences about seeing, you know, like picking up a falcon that they had found over at Romney Climbing Rocks, and I, you know, bring it home real quick before I take it down to Maria Colby, and like that, you know, who gets to see like a falcon, you know, right, hanging out type deal.
I'm assuming it was a peregrine.
Yep. Yep. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, exactly. Or just anything. I think a couple months ago somebody caught like a ermine, you know, a short tail weasel. It was all, but it was all in its winter colors, pure white. So I'm like, well,
and wait till they get older, because
I'll come and get it and bring it home and see. Everybody saw it for, you know, it's still in its cage and everything before I release it. But
I'm always amazed, like my son, that the information he has gathered and the information he knows that he can pass on, like wildlife ID.
Yeah.
You know, he'd know a peregrine falcon right quick because he's seen them. And, you know, it's just interesting to see him interact with other kids of his age and the wildlife knowledge he knows just because of, like you said, the exposure to it through the family group and how he shares it with his class and stuff like that. So it's very unique as we go. And we support each other too. I mean, wives support each other as a group. It's a big family, and it has to be, because we deal with a lot of different things and a lot of different activities. And, you know, we have our ups and downs as well. So it's good to have that support among the districts, among the state. So. But, and I think nationwide, that's a lot of it. I see it slipping away maybe a little. And I'm not even going to say the new generation, just the way things are done. I don't think we're so family orientated as a group. I say that, and then I think of some of the people that are. So I hope that stays, because I think it's necessary for our job.
Yeah, definitely. And because you can't, well, I won't say you can't, but a lot of people, being part of a family is like, you know, your micro community. And then as a game warden, especially in New Hampshire, like you have to be a part of your community. You're not going to be successful. You're not going to be as successful if nobody knows who you are. You just drive around and then, you know, they're like, well, there goes John. But, you know, I talked to him once and he seemed like kind of a jerk. Like you really have to be a member of your community in order to know what's going on, know people, have somebody trust you enough to come up to you and say, hey, I don't want to be a rat, but Billy's doing this and I don't think that's right. And that it's funny. That's a lot of what we do is that. And for me, it's all how you interact with people. And it's funny that I feel like I'm the same person regardless of whether I have on a uniform that has a patch that says conservation officer, or I'm just walking around and down in town and somebody's talking to me. I don't feel like I'm a different person when I put on a gun and a badge, and I'm like the same thing. I don't feel like I'm a different person when I'm at my house. Maybe a little bit with Carla, maybe a little bit. I'm
You don't order her around, do you?
No, exactly.
Yeah, but that didn't go well in my house either.
But I don't treat, you know, I try, like I said before, I try and treat everybody the way that I would want them to treat me, and that seems to work out well. And
No, that's a great way, I think, to end this podcast, John. So, but thanks for sitting down and answering all these questions. Our first format like this, which I thought was pretty intriguing, seemed like a perfect amount of questions. A little overlap in some of them, so people are thinking of the same type of thoughts as, you know, they're watching Northwoods Law and they're listening to the Warden's Watch podcast.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
Wow. Fuck, great. Appreciate it.
Thanks for coming all the way down to Thornton, New Hampshire. Yeah, and well, going over to Romney.
I know your wife facilitated this, and I was like, well, if I'm going to do that, would John be available for an interview? And she's like, absolutely. And I don't think she ran it by you.
Well, that's all right. It goes unspoken, right?
Well, that's great. Thanks a lot.
Please join me, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and other Game Wardens on our adventures protecting wildlife, saving lives, and having fun, all while serving the public and the natural resources of our planet. Listen to the tales and experience of those who work in the outdoors while being entertained with stories about encounters with poachers, wildlife investigation, murder investigation, near-death experiences, search and rescue missions, wildlife interactions from game wardens around the country and around the world. When I retired, I realized I couldn't let go of that legacy, but rather wanted to share the passion, the commitment, and the stories of those men and women that call themselves game wardens. This is Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and this is Warden's Watch.